but they didn't want to know about the U-plane, for instance. Mm. And of course, that is staggering. I mean, again, with hindsight, of course, people will start, you know, it just shows how stupid people are. You know about the U-plane.
Well, that's what, as far as I can gather, yes, Ivor has you down as an inventor. And
well, I'm more than an inventor. I mean, I invent certain things or discover certain things, but then if it's important enough or interesting enough, then I follow it up with a full design and produce it. The only thing where I stop is I do not produce it for as manufacture for other people, because I'm not really interested in using this any item to make money.
Are you saying you manufactured a U-plane?
Well, no, I built a U-plane, made a robot, you know, which is a small U-plane, which was photographed for 4 hours by 8 people from Yorkshire Television in the test facility of the University of Cardiff, of Wales, the Welsh University, and was radio-controlled. So, of course, you can build this bigger and sit in it if you want to, or you can hang bombs on it and use it then to detonate things. I mean, the fact that it was small does not invalidate what it did.
Can I get this clear? This is an aeroplane that can go underwater as well?
No, not at all.
Oh,
no. The principle is very simple, that up till now, every ship in the world was built to be lighter than the water it displaces.
Yeah.
And that's why it floats. A submarine is additionally then flooded with ballast to get rid of the extra buoyancy that brings it up, so that it becomes neutrally buoyant.
Yeah.
And once it's neutrally buoyant, then it's like an airship, which is just adjusted in its weight lift ratio so that it floats without going up and down.
Right.
Or any balloon, as a matter of fact.
Yes, I see.
Right? Yeah. Now, with the U-plane, it has in addition wings, which also supported in addition to buoyancy. And that means you now can build the craft, of course, heavier than water. And that means you remove the limitation which normally limits the wall strength of the crew compartment. You can't make it yards thick because it would be too heavy. So that even without ballast, it would then simply sink. But when you have wings, then it becomes a sort of airship that is heavier than the air, but uses the additional support from the wing, and then, of course, it can carry that extra weight.
But presumably it has to keep going all the time. If it stops,
yes,
it'll sink.
In that particular case, yes. So that, I mean, unless it's a helicopter, then it can also be stationary. But the point is, it requires power while moving in order to support the extra weight. But it removes the limitation, so that you now can have a craft which can have walls for the crew compartment to protect the crew from the outside pressure, and this crew compartment can have walls a yard thick, whatever is required, so that you can now go down with a crew which is roomy in sufficient space, even for scientists and passengers and people, and you can go down to the bottom of the Pacific or Atlantic, wherever you want to go. And once you remove the limitation, well, then, of course, the whole seafloor becomes available for human endeavor, which means exploration and exploitation. And since 7/10 of the globe, there's more seafloor than there is dry ground, and there's no interference by human beings living anywhere, I mean, the amount of minerals and gas and oil and everything else is of course far more than there is on the surface.
But you've got the high pressure, haven't you? You'd be under diving sort of conditions, wouldn't you?
No, you misunderstood. The whole thing is that you sit in a compartment which protects you from the outside pressure.
Yeah, but if you want it, so. But you can't
You're sitting in there in absolutely a normal air pressure.
Yeah, but you can't get out, can you? If you want to sort of go around and dig up the minerals.
No, you don't do that. That's quite correct. I mean, everything you do is like virtual reality. You have gloves which you put on, and then everything you move with your fingers is repeated outside by manipulators.
I see. I just understood why you call it a U-plane.
Because I was German-born, and the Germans called their submarines U-boats.
Yes, right.
And this is not a boat, but a U-plane, that, you know, undersea plane.
I understand. It is at the same time, it is a rather confusing name, isn't it?
But it's original and just as well, because it's now being manufactured for the Navy of various outside countries.
Hmm. Really?
Well, of course. I mean, I got in detail when I found out that in Britain they didn't want to know or didn't appreciate it, or even though Britain at one time was a seafaring nation and one of the top nations when it comes to seafaring, not to be interested, of course, was staggering stupidity. But when I found this out, then I said to myself, well, you can't force people, you can't force good deeds down anybody.
Presumably, once it's down, you have to have something like a runway to get it up again.
Yes, but you see, when you, I don't know whether you're old enough, but you must remember a couple of years ago there were reports constantly by the Swedes complaining about somebody crawling around their coastline.
Mm.
And they found out when they put the camera down that there were tracks on the seabed, and they thought, they didn't understand what this was until I got in contact with them and explained to them that they were the landing marks and takeoff marks of U-planes. And because, of course, they only need a speed of something like more than 5-8 knots in order to get enough lift, that means that they're only a couple of yards. So it's not you don't need a runway, you just need any particular flat spot.
Is that because water is more viscous than air?
Yeah, because we're in an aeroplane like a 747 takes off and lands at speeds above something like about 200 miles at least. So, of course,
yes, I see.
With a U-plane, the speed range is from 5 to 50.
And the wings have, you know, an aerofoil cross-section and...
Well, similar to... Yeah, well, I mean, all that is of course, nothing new. This is all, what do you call it, standard practice.
Yes, I see what you mean. What's the difference between this and a submarine? It's just the weight business, is it?
Exactly, that by removing, by supporting it two ways, by buoyancy and added to this wing lift, you can, you are not limited, the weight is not limited like hitherto to that of the displaced water. And that means you now can provide a crew compartment which has, on the one hand, enough space for people to stay in for a longish while. And the other thing is, of course, you have sufficient energy and there's no limitation.
Can you make them bigger, presumably, as well?
Well, you can, any size, but then, of course, using aero engineering practices, you don't need 10 people to steer it. I mean, you have an autopilot where you have a little button, you have a little knob, one is, gives you the direction, the other one the depth, and the third is the degree of change. And because, of course, this is, I mean, this is like a little remote control you hold in your hand.
What's the difference between this and a submarine that has, with fins on it?
Well, the big difference is the weight, the lack of a limitation in weight. A normal submarine can't go deeper than about a couple of 1,000 feet, or in meters, something like 800 meters. And even then it has to be built from titanium and expensive material.
Right, you mean it would get squashed if it did?
Exactly. Well, that's what's happening. The moment it goes down more than 8,000 feet, of course, it gets squashed. And don't forget, it needs not to get squashed everywhere. It's only if there's a small entry of water, let's say the front or rear, well, that bit, of course, will become heavier and will then hang down. And once it hangs down, of course, it's unmaneuverable.
Mm.
And with the U-plane, you have no limitation. So you can have a crew compartment for the crew, and you can have extra compartment and sleeping quarters, and of course live there.
So in other words, the average density of the whole thing becomes more than one, more than seawater.
Well, exactly, but there is no problem. That is, of course, the basics. And then, of course, because I came up against other people, you know, always asking what's happening when the engine failed. Well, of course, in the first place, you have more than one engine, and one power supply, which includes, of course, separate supply as well, so so that if one fails, you have a totally independent section again. That's number two. My designs all actually have three designs, three engines, three power supplies.
So you've got the same problem as an aeroplane, but upside down, haven't you? Instead of falling out of the sky.
But the other thing is, of course, when you land, or when you have to dive down or glide down, you're arriving at the seabed with about 15 miles, not 150 miles. So you're not going to, even if you hit something, indentation or a little boulder or something, even that wouldn't, I mean, 50 miles is nothing.
Right. How does the speed compare with a submarine, say? It's about the same.
Well, it can be higher because, as I say, the same limitations that are removed as far as the crew compartment is concerned also applies to the engine. You can now have a battery compartment which is 9/10 of the whole size of the ship. So you can have enough battery power or fuel cell power.
Right, I was going to say you don't need a nuclear motor or something.
Well, you don't need to, but of course that is even better. But the ideal, which I discussed with various other navies, is to have battery that is enough to cross the Atlantic from one end to the other. So you don't need diesel engines. But then you have a small power supply, which constantly works full blast, and is very tiny, and just gives enough to operate as a constant charger unit for the batteries.
Yes, I see what you mean. That's interesting.
You understand? So like a freezer, like a fridge in your home, that when the battery gets down below a certain percentage of its volume in terms of capacity, well, then the charger starts charging it.
Yes,
Then, of course, you can go around the world. And that means you save the money for a supply ship. You don't need a mothership at the surface, which can't operate the whole thing, as it's done with robots nowadays, because it costs £50,000 or $50,000 or so for one day for the ship to just sit there.
Yes, I imagine.
And then, of course, the other thing is that all these things like Ballard, who looked at the Titanic. Well, yeah, he can go. It takes a couple of hours to get down there. It takes a couple of hours to come up. So he has about 2 hours to go around that Titanic and take a few photographs.
Have you got windows on this thing? Can you have very thick glass?
In my designs, I opted for everything is electronic. In other words, you have no opening except the entrance. So that everything is optically or by radio from outside inside, you know.
But there must be glass panels to let light through, mustn't there?
No. You have whatever you see inside, you see on your on your scopes.
Yeah, but what I mean is there must be some.
No, there's nothing whatsoever. What you press a button and you see what's going on outside.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the outside consisted of. I mean, it's not just a completely smooth shell, is it? There must be.
Oh, it's a streamlining, but it has the outside streamlining. It's just the streamlining around the main thing. When all these designs are, of course, finalized years ago, and of course the designer is free to choose whatever design they want.
Yeah.
And
when did you think of this idea?
Years ago.
Is it your idea?
Well, it started in 1928, because in 1928 I was experimenting with model aircraft wings. I wanted to find out whether a round wing tip or a straight wing tip, whether there's any advantage of having it round. And I made a wooden model, which I then pulled through with an elastic band from one end of the bathtub to the other. And I expected that the better wing side, provided the wings on both sides of the model were the same area, then the one that had a better tip would produce more lift, and that would end it up, you were tilted over.
Yeah.
And of course, as a result of making it from wood, I didn't want it to float, so I had to screw pieces of lead underneath it to make it heavy enough to stay inside the water. And that became the U-plane. And it was not... Well, it was something very obvious.
Yeah.
And later, of course, people started, asking me, are the Germans going to use this in the war? And I expected they would, because I thought it's so obvious that, you understand, that the other thing was, of course, once I started working on military side of it, then it was obvious that I would put the torpedoes on the sides, you know, under the wings or on the side, like it is, like you have bombs with an aircraft, so that when you shoot them off, you don't have to push them through to torpedo tubes.
Right.
And that means you can have different diameters. You can have a small one for a small ship and a real whopper if you want to sink a battleship or something. And, you know...
That's interesting. 1920. Did you patent it? Is it possible?
Oh, yes, I patented it. And then because I had conversation with people who constantly worried about what happens if all the engines fail and this, that, and the other. Well, first of all, if the engine, everything fails and it lands on the seabed, it would not be the only one in the world that sits there. I mean, I would expect that, for instance, a Far Eastern Navy produces a couple of several hundred or a few thousand. Well, they would operate as groups.
Mm.
And then, of course, if one really is stranded, then another one goes and pulls it up. That's number one. But then, of course, I devoted quite a part of the patent to what I then called an artificial swim bladder. And that is actually quite ingenious in a way, because if you have a balloon, which is, flattened because of the outside pressure, which it goes alongside the outside of the fuselage, you understand?
Yep.
In an indentation on the fuselage so it doesn't stick out, it's
right.
Very streamlined. But if you want to produce lift by buoyancy, added to that of the actual compartments themselves, well then you use a bit of water from the outside and filter out the salt, and then by electrolysis you split the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And the hydrogen then goes into the swim bladders and inflates them.
Good.
While the oxygen can be used not only for breathing, but it can also be used for combining with in a fuel cell with material which produces electricity.
Would that do the materials exist to do that? Because it would be under horrendous...
Well, of course, fuel cells have been invented.
No, not fuel cells. No, I meant a rubber bladder thing, because it would be under horrendous pressure, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but it would have the same pressure from the inside.
Hmm. I see what you mean.
That's the point. It's inflated with gas, hydrogen, which is under the same pressure as the water outside.
Hmm.
So it, or a bit more, just to give it a bit of form or stability. And once you've done that, of course, you go up to the surface anyway. And in my second patent, I used this principle to have not just one swim bladder, which would be enough to overcome its own extra weight, but you can have another 10 swim bladders, which you only inflate if you want to lift something from the bottom of the ocean.
Right. Oh, I see. So you could have grapnels or something.
Exactly. In fact, in the design and the patent, it looks like these... things they have at harbours, you know, to carry containers between four legs.
If you've got swim bladders, couldn't you just get an ordinary submarine and equip it with these things?
Yes, but you see,
that wouldn't be so strong, though.
You're quite right, but the trouble with the conventional submarine is that it's built from the outside with very weak walls, because they cannot afford to make the walls stronger, because then it wouldn't come up at all, unless it has these swim bladders.
Yes, that seems to me that's interesting, yeah.
So in other words, of course, this is why the first patent, the thing is called the U-plane.
Yeah.
And in the second patent, it is called the transbuoyant submarine craft. Means by transbuoyant, it means that if you don't inflate more than the one, or don't inflate the one, then it's heavier than water. If you inflate one, then it's neutrally buoyant. Or a bit more than, in other words, like a submarine. And if you inflate the other 90% of swim bladders, which could be another 20 or 100, well, then, of course, you can lift an enormous amount, depending on how strong your grapplers are. And in fact, because it's designed and patented in modular form, you can actually connect, imagine like it's a railway train, and it's like one railway wagon, which is just one big cylinder with all these swim bladders in it, and you can connect 20 one behind the other. Then, of course, you have 20 times the lifting power. And furthermore, you can have bridges to a second line, side by side, or even you know, like an H, yes. When you look at an H written, when you look at it from above. And you can have, you know, a parallel system like that, one on top of the other. So you can lift anything that's on the ground, on you know, and especially if it has these legs like harbor carrier, cargo carrier. Well, then of course it's built for this purpose, so you can carry, you know, for pipes for oil drilling and this, of course, in between your legs. So of course this is all designed. You see, that's the difference between an invention and a design. An invention usually is the basic idea.
Right.
A design is when you spend a couple of years in developing that into a product which any engineering firm can go and produce.
Right. I just, when I asked about patenting, I mean, the point about patents is you patent the way something is done, don't you? And I just wondered if it was possible to patent your idea.
Well, they're both patented, and they're both running, and they're both valid, and
the
of course...
Patent is, okay, the patent covers anything of that sort, does it?
Well,
it's not possible for somebody to make a similar design that gets around your patent.
There's no way that anybody can get around it, because it includes all these possibilities. Mm. You know, there are 50 pages of it. You see, normally, when one is a firm, the intention when patenting is to cover yourself on the one hand. On the other hand, you don't want to give too much away.
Right, yes, I know.
Yeah. But I found out that probably because of the notices or this interference or whatever, that whatever I wanted to publish was not published. So I used the patent office to put all this into written form. As a result, of course, it's known all over the world, but there's so much in it that from the point of originality,
yeah.
Of course, no, it's pretty impossible for anybody to invent anything that's not already contained in there.
Yes, I see.
You understand?
Yes,
but
I do.
On the other hand, because I realized with the military implications and all this, if the Americans or the Russians want to build it, they're going to build it whether I have a patent or not. So I didn't waste any money on getting patents throughout the world. I only took patents out in Britain, and then mainly, as I explained, for the purpose of putting my seal on it, you know, my name on it.
Mm.
And the problem is now, of course, that because of the military implications, is that, of course, the whole world is working on it, and whichever country, well, the fact is that Britain has now lost out completely, so if any major problem arises now in the future, there is no hope for Britain whatsoever, because it takes only one U-plane to sink any of the oil tankers on the way to America, and the oil price in America will go up tenfold, and that will cause a total economic collapse.
Just one tanker?
Well, because, of course, then it will be known that every other tanker is dead off.
Is vulnerable. Mm.
And don't forget, because these things are, what do you call it, so... in fact, you know, like an aeroplane, instead of having a crew in a submarine of 100, you would have a crew not more than 6 at the most. And that's only because of sleeping arrangement. So that, you know, when... because... so you can have run shifts, but normally you need only one person to handle the whole thing.
Mm.
And of course that means that you can have thousands. It's like, I mean, the cost of one U-plane is less than that of a tank. Well, like a tank, let's say.
Yes, that's what you mean. Yes.
And of course it's absolutely lethal. And that's why I got invitation from all the embassies of the major nations to visit them and...
When was that? When were these?
All over the years. I mean, this has been going on since years.
Since 1928?
No.
When did you patent?
Out in 1957.
I see.
And I found then there was no interest in Britain. I then dropped the patent, and thereby risking, of course, that somebody else might patent it, but they didn't. And I re-patented the whole thing, slightly differently written, because, of course, in the years in between, I concentrated a little bit more on the on the safety aspects, you know, because of all these this experience I had with discussing people who always worried about what happened if this and that happened. So, but otherwise it was the same thing. I repatented it in 1984, and the patent is running since then. That's now 12 years. And the reason I patented it then is because of the appearance of Russian U-planes or similar things around Sweden. And the Russians knew about it in 1957 because when I patented it in Britain, I got acquainted with a chap whom I didn't know where he came from, and it turned out later that he worked for the Russian embassy.
Oh, really?
Now, I didn't tell him any technical, design features, but I was discussing with him, of course, the advantages of going into the U-plane design. So, in other words, it's like explaining to somebody how a bird flies and the advantages compared to any other system, without necessarily telling him how to design the wings and whether to make a biplane or a monoplane.
So they did something
on their own. But they probably were started off by what I told them.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because did the chap, was he technically competent? I mean, did he know what he was talking about?
Oh, yes, it turned out later that he was very competent. But to me, that's why I talked to him, because I like talking to people who've got brains. Yeah. I don't want to waste my time talking to idiots.
There was some connection with Wireless World, was there not? Are you one of these people who have published in Wireless World?
Oh, yes, it turned out that the Wireless World... Well, there was another thing that... during the war, or rather before the war, I have to explain to you one other thing then. I worked during the wartime, or just before it, in the Middle East, in Palestine, for the Civil Aviation Department.
Of the British
Mandate Government.
Right.
And first in the meteorology and later in air traffic and all these other things. And as a result, of course, I was known to the various people there, among them one person who was the technical director of the Palestine Broadcasting Service, a highly intelligent man, and he had contacts, of course, with the top RAF people and everybody, and in a conversation with him, we were talking about navigation problems of the RAF. And I explained that I knew a system that could give the position of the aircraft at all times and couldn't be jammed. And he had discussed this also with RAF people, and they said, well, if there's anything like this, we need it badly. So I was asked to make a design, and that was the invention of inertial navigation.
You invented inertial navigation?
Yeah. And I then was asked, because that was so a bit too far ahead for everybody, I was asked then to combine this with a system that worked by radio, using loop aerials.
Yeah.
And I did that, and I was then asked to submit this to the British government, which I did. And because at that time I worked for the Civil Aviation Department, of course, the submission went through the various official channels, you know, through my boss and his boss and so on. And as a result, the whole thing was, not legal, but...
approved?
Well, not approved, but was part of the file system of the British government.
I see.
In other words, that's why I could prove everything.
Right.
And the British government wanted it, and they passed it on to Marconi for their technical assessment, and they turned it down, or some idiot there turned it down. And because of that, it was not accepted, and it was not passed on to the manufactured. And the interesting thing is that the letters which went on this subject. Was not addressed to me, but was direct. The Marconi letter was addressed to the director of civil aviation.
Mm.
And I only got a copy.
So you were kind
of
cut
course,
out.
As a result, of course, it has file numbers and everything.
Mm.
And when there was this argument two years ago, about the bombing of Dresden and giving a medal and a memorial to Bomber Harris.
Bomber Harris, yeah.
And there was all this argument. I then decided to help the RAF and make this public. So in other words, I wanted to show that the reason that Bomber Harris was not, that the RAF was not possible to win the war by air power alone, as Bomber Harris had hoped for and intended, was not because the RAF wasn't capable of doing it, but because of the sabotage by people in Marconi who prevented the RAF to get the systems and equipment which they could have had.
You mean, you mean the navigation was not good enough?
Well, it turned out later, when this whole thing was published in the Wireless World, one chap who apparently worked for Marconi and may have been the man who actually turned it down, he then, in writing, in a letter which he sent into the Wireless World, made it public that, to use his words, more aeroplanes were, of the RAF, Bomber Command, and so on, were lost on the way home than were shot down by the Germans.
Yes.
And that means that, well, because, of course, by that time they were short on fuel and probably damaged and tired, and they couldn't find their home base because of fog and bad weather in Britain. And the least that my system could have done is at least help them to get home.
When was that invented?
In 1939.
Can you briefly explain how, I mean, inertial navigation is sensitive to the way you move, isn't it? It's like a, like an earthquake detector or something.
Yes, exactly, yeah. But of course, I combined it with a moving map, and so, which was also controlled by the output from loop aerials. A rolling map, so that a light point or a cross on the map showed exactly where you were all the time. Cool. And you could feed that also into an autopilot, so that the plane could fly to the target, drop the bombs, and come back without being touched by human hand. And of course, the whole thing could also be incorporated in flying bombs, so you didn't have to have any people, Bomber Command, flying out there at all.
That was available even in 1939.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, I was then visited by the editor of the, or the former editor who had just retired from the Wireless World.
Was that Thomas Ivel?
No, it was Philip Darrington.
Oh, right.
He even came to visit me, and I showed him all the original letters and the official documentation and everything, and that was then published in the Wireless World. And of course, everybody could see then, with hindsight, that of course that was no problem. In fact, I built a working item within 2 afternoons.
Oh, right.
I mean, there was nothing to it, really. And
does that mean that all the fuss about radar was somewhat overstated? I mean.
No, radar was a separate thing invented by other people and was very good, but the navigation system, of course, would have made it possible for the RAF, first of all, not to lose all those planes on the way home. They could have been reused with their crews the next day, and that would have made the whole power of the RAF so much more efficient. In fact, in interviews with Speer, the German Minister of Armament, he was quoted and shown on BBC that if the attack on Hamburg, something like that, would have been repeated a few times more, Germany would have capitulated. And the only reason they couldn't repeat those attacks was because of the losses on the way home of all these aircraft.
We just didn't have enough planes.
Well, because they were lost on the way home. And that could have been prevented simply by having a navigation system that showed them exactly where they were and how to get home.
That's an extraordinary story. Is that in, you know, there's a book by Jones called Most Secret War? I forget his first name, somebody Jones.
Yeah, I was in contact with him by letter, but he, you know, all these people are a bit elderly now.
I just wondered if he mentioned it in his book. So that was a kind of technical history of...
No, he didn't know that until I sent him a letter later. But you see...
Did he acknowledge it? I mean, did he...
Oh, yes, but I found out later that in the same year he lost his wife who died, and then his daughter died, and...
I see.
And, you know, all these people, they are a little bit past it in a way.
Yes, he didn't want to produce a revised version of his book. Because that's quite an important story, isn't it? I mean, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, it's 4 pages in the Wireless World, and you understand? You see, my point is now, I'm getting a bit fed up with all this as well, so that I've decided well, a few years ago when I found out I was talking to a brick wall, I really lost my temper in the end. In fact, I have a letter here by Lord Lewin, who was Admiral of the fleet, and he was in charge of the defense staff a couple of years ago, and he can't do much about this whole thing. Well, you're dealing, this is where we're coming back to human nature. We're dealing here a country like Britain, which is on the way out. It's hopeless. I mean, these people here living in the past, they don't have any appreciation or comprehension of technology and science, and they don't comprehend what I'm talking about.
Do you include Lewin in that?
Well, all these people, they are now, I mean, this is where, this is why it is very valuable if you want to have a real good idea what's going on in the world, you would have to come and visit me, because it's all here in writing. I mean, all these people, this is what in a way is so nice about them, but I feel terribly sorry about these people. You see, all this is a fact of life, and I got it all here, and you can see it. They're not realizing that the problem is not that they are not decent or willing to help, but that they do not comprehend.
They're just not very bright.
Well, that is an unkind way of saying it.